Welcome back to Talk Talk Nation. I'm your host, Joe Weber, and join with me this week is the head janitor and check writer of Gunther Works, the Mr. Peter Nam. Thank you, Peter, for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I just want to be clear, I did not come up with that title. He gave that to me. Peter is the founder of Gunther Works. Would you say you're a Porsche tuner or remasterer? I know that term's been thrown around.
I mean, any category you want. You know, we just work on Porsches and we try our best to make them, you know, as performance and beautiful as possible. So,
yeah. And they are beautiful. If you've ever seen a Gunther Works in the wild, just know it's the brainchild of Peter. And what I learned today, your wife, Cecilia, is part of the business as well. And you guys have known each other for going on 30 years now.
Yeah, close to that.
Yeah. So it is, Gunther Works is a family business, which I did not know before this. I think that's very cool. Why don't we start at the beginning? Were you a car guy first? Or I know that you studied something else in college, right?
Yeah, I studied finance in Boston University.
Okay. So it's only a matter of time before you got into Porsches.
So yeah, I was always a car nut, and I really started, my love of cars started with BMWs.
Cool.
So I was a BMW nut. And then, over the years, I graduated into Porsches. I still love BMWs. Most of my collections are BMWs.
Oh, wow.
But, fell in love with Porsches, working on them. And, here we are 9 years later, right?
Oh, it's been 9 years so far.
Yeah. This is our 9th year anniversary for Gunther Works.
Wow. You kind of started Gunther Works at a time when, like, I would say desecrating old Porsches was frowned upon. Mm-hmm. Rod Emery was doing his thing. The outlaw Porsche term had been coined. Mm-hmm. Did you have a different ethos going into building your Porsches than say like go against the purists? Did you want to cater to the purists?
Definitely not.
No.
I was getting quite a bunch of crap from the purists. You would see people online or on Facebook groups going, oh my God, you ruined the car. You should have left it original and kept it stock. And I don't think we ever were catering to that market. What we were trying to do is try to take the 993 platform, and basically have an open checkbook. And what can we do to maximize the performance of the car? That's fundamentally the ethos behind it is performance. And how far can we take it? And then after we've done the performance, we try to make the car as beautiful as possible. So that was really our ethos, is we are a very performance-minded company. And the looks are sort of a byproduct of the engineering.
That's so interesting to hear because it is such a beautiful car. The one that's sitting in our parking lot right now. I'd say all of your cars that you make are beautiful and just very tasteful. And to hear that performance comes first is awesome to hear, but it's also just like, then the purists have nothing to say about it. They don't really have a leg to stand on.
Well, it's hard to argue with performance numbers, right?
Yeah.
So the track times that we do, our turbo is like producing lap times at Laguna Seca that are on par with modern hypercars, right?
Holy crap.
So you can't really argue with those kind of things. Obviously, looks and sort of paint and all those things can be more subjective. And some people love it. Some people hate it. We do our best to cater to the clientele that we have. But, it's hard to argue with performance numbers.
Yeah. So backing up a little bit, you said you grew up in Boston?
No, I grew up all over the place. Yeah. I grew up, born in Korea, lived in Kuwait, then moved to Hong Kong, and then I went to Florida for tennis school.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, before I went to Boston.
Wow.
Yeah.
What was it like living in Florida?
I actually loved it.
Yeah?
Yeah, yeah. I went to a tennis academy full-time because I was trying to be, a pro tennis player.
Yeah.
But I quickly realized after I started, training at the academy that there were so many good people. And that my career probably would end up as the local neighborhood tennis coach, but I was there for 5 years and I just loved playing tennis. And I was there with, players like Andre Agassi,
Wow.
Kournikova.
You trained with him?
Yeah, they were around us, you know, and the Williams sisters,
wow.
Tommy Haas. My roommate actually lost to Anna Kournikova in a men's tennis match, and we made fun of him for 3 months that he lost to a 13-year-old girl.
You know? Oh, she was 13 at the time?
Wow. Yeah.
I mean, that's a flex, though.
Yeah. I mean, she was amazing back then. You know? So, yeah. She wasn't even playing women's tennis. She was playing men's tennis because she was just wiping the floor clean with all the women.
She's so above.
Yeah.
Wow. Exactly. That's crazy. So what, do you still play tennis?
I don't because I had a little knee surgery twice, so I don't play tennis as much. But
what about pickleball?
I do play pickleball. Pickleball's fun. Yeah. Tennis players make fun of pickleball saying, you know, there's people that don't know how to play tennis are playing pickleball.
I would imagine that. I still love pickleball.
Yeah, pickleball is fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So your tennis dreams are smashed. You love cars, but do you feel like finance was the way to get into cars, or how did you make the leap to finance?
So my original dream was to become an investment banker. You know, I love the action and I love the thrill of being in finance.
Yeah.
And so that's why I studied finance in school. And unfortunately, when I graduated, it was the year 2000 and the dot-com bubble burst and the stock market was crashing. And then the following year was 9/11. So
oh my God.
There were not a lot of good jobs at Wall Street back then. You know, I couldn't even get like an internship. I was, you know, in Boston, realized I couldn't really find a job in Wall Street in finance. So I temporarily moved out to Southern California in 2000 and I started car parts, you know, selling car parts as a hobby.
Okay. Right?
And one day.
Did you just kind of have innately like good knowledge of what you could flip or? You had like an eye for that sort of thing?
So I was making, you know, selling aftermarket car parts that were not full cars, right? And I was always, you know, sort of naturally a creative person, but I never pursued a career in art.
Yeah.
I was actually recruited to go to Parsons School of Design.
Oh, wow.
Early on, you know, because I was, you know, it was very easy for me for painting and doing artistic work and, but I wanted to go into business, you know, and finance. So
you have so many different facets.
Yeah.
The tennis thing, the car thing, the finance thing.
Yeah. So yeah, I started selling car parts and one day I decided I want to, you know, I thought I could make the parts better myself. And so I ended up connecting with someone that worked at Boeing. He was making carbon fiber composite parts for Boeing.
That's pretty early too for carbon fiber.
Mm-hmm. And they had invented a new vacuum production process, vacuum bagging production process called vacuum infusion. And it was very, very ahead of its time because it was used primarily in aerospace. And so that's kind of the genesis of the carbon fiber production is I started with one employee and it was me and him. It was a two-man show.
In your garage somewhere?
We had a office space.
Cool.
Where we would make all these parts. It was like a 1,500 square foot office. Not very big.
Just like breathing, you know, polyethylene and stuff.
Yeah,
like that.
Breathing the resin. Yeah. That's lost a couple of brain cells doing that for a few years.
What parts did you start with?
The first part I made was a BMW hood.
Oh,
yeah, that
cool.
was for an M3.
I would think that. You know, that's a pretty flat piece that, you know, maybe hard to mess up.
No, it's actually not. So it was a vented.
Oh, okay.
It was a vented hood. So there was a lot of vents on it.
Yeah.
It was actually very complex to laminate the carbon fiber and make the weave look straight and perfect.
Yeah.
So it wasn't just a factory flat hood.
It was
it was a race hood. It was a vented race hood.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah. So we did carbon fiber, then we branched out into wheels. And we then went to other makes like, you know, Lamborghini, Porsche, Audi, Ferrari, and all kinds of different, you know, brands.
What was the moment you realized that this might hit on something and you got a bunch of, you know, attention over some part?
I think, you know, I financially struggled in the early years for a lot. It was really, you know, living paycheck to paycheck. And finally, when we could comfortably pay the rent, I was like, okay, I got something going on here. So,
that's cool. Yeah. It's cool to have just that little morsel of security.
Right.
Yeah. So how did you make the leap from making individual parts to being like, I think I want to make a whole car?
So that kind of started like a little over 10 years ago, where when I was working on all these modern cars, like from BMW, Porsche, Ferrari, Lamborghini, these cars, I would say like 10 years ago, started becoming a little too digital and becoming very heavy. The cars were faster, but they became more numb and boring to drive.
Yeah.
And they sort of lost their soul, right? And I felt like I wanted to take an analog car, like a 993, and give it modern technology, but give the technology where it enhances the driving experience and makes it even better, more emotionally engaging to drive, but also have modern performance, have Bluetooth, have proper handling, have a, you know, high performance motor. And because I was doing manufacturing for 20 something years, making our own carbon fiber, making our own wheels, I had a lot of manufacturing background that allowed me to transition into building a full car, because we were practically almost there.
Yeah. You've been doing these steps for all these years. And finally, you get to the point where you're like, hey, I can just do the whole thing by myself. I don't have to worry about, you know, fitting something to a car I didn't make. You make your own car.
That was the idea. But of course, it was a very, very steep learning curve.
It's I would imagine.
It's like you look at an iceberg and you see the top of the iceberg and you're like, oh, that's not that big.
I can climb that.
But no one told you that the iceberg is really big underneath the water. It's like 80% of the size of the iceberg is underneath the water.
And the tolerances of the iceberg are like within a 1 millimeter. And if you mess that up.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, I went through a lot of learning, very, very steep learning curve.
Yeah.
Not just making parts, but being able to put the cars together, build the cars consistently while maintaining that quality. And creating a production system to be able to repeat these cars consistently.
What was the biggest, most frustrating mistake that you ran into during this period?
I think dealing with staff was the staffing was the most challenging thing, because we're in Southern California. The positive benefits is we're around a lot of talented people. The negative is it's a very competitive area to be in.
Yeah.
In Southern California, there's a lot of automotive brands around here. And, you know, we had spent a lot of time training people on how to build our cars. And then 1 year or 2 years later, they would ask for like a ridiculous raise, or they would start going to these other electric car companies that were overpaying for people because they were basically startups.
They were getting poached.
Yeah, they were poaching a lot of our staff. And it was very frustrating to like train people.
Yeah.
And then get literally blackmailed by them to like, you know, double or triple salaries. And then if we couldn't do it, they would leave to another brand for $1 more. You know, it was just very disheartening.
That sucks.
Yeah. So those were some of the biggest challenges we had, is maintaining consistent level of staff and the amount of training that you need. When you're hand building a vehicle, it's not robotically done, you know?
Yeah.
It's not automated. It's hand done. It's a craft. And the training, it takes a long time for one of these people to be able to touch a client's car. And so, you know, all that investment is gone if someone, you know, learns all that and leaves. So,
yeah. That's just like throwing money down the drain.
Pretty much, yeah.
And that does, it does suck. this whole time, are you kind of boots on the ground doing all of this alongside your mechanics and engineers?
Yeah.
So you're learning as they're learning too, at least in the beginning.
Right. It's very, very hands-on.
Yeah.
It's a very hands-on business. We have a very small team. You know, we're less than 100 people. So it's very, very intimate, small, and we don't have a lot of politics in our company. So we make decisions very, very quickly.
That's great.
And I'm very much involved in the day to day.
That's cool. Yeah. How many cars do you make a year?
So that's a great question. We were trying to make two cars per month. Unfortunately, we had some slowdowns last year, especially because of supply chain problems.
Yeah.
That we didn't have enough parts to be able to make that goal. But our goal this year is to make between 24 to 30 cars.
Oh, great. Yeah. That's a decent amount.
Mm-hmm.
Did you run into any problems with tariffs and sourcing parts from abroad?
So that's one of the good things about us is we manufacture everything in Huntington Beach, California.
Oh, that's awesome.
So there is no tariffs. There's very few components coming from Europe, like certain engine components or some magnesium components that we do source from Europe.
Yeah.
That had a very, very heavy tariff, or there's a lot of original Porsche classic parts that we buy from Porsche.
Okay.
And that obviously affected the supply chain for Porsche themselves.
Yeah.
So we've seen a lot of delays and price increases related to the tariffs. Yeah.
Can you walk me through how a client comes to you and orders a car? What does that process look like?
So we don't, you know, really advertise. So most of the clients come to us through our social media or our website or email. We get contacted by the client saying that they've heard about us, or there's a lot of client referrals from like different client friends and associates that get referred over. And typically they would bring a 993 donor car on their own.
We talked about this a little bit in the kitchen, but you don't get bodies in white. I think Porsche stopped doing that in the late 2010s, but you've never done bodies in white from the factory.
No, unfortunately, we can't. There's no program available.
Yeah.
Especially 993s.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's a historic.
Yeah. So we typically start with a 1995 to 1998 911 993. And either the client brings the car to us, or we can assist the client in sourcing the car, the donor car. And then we would strip the car down and start the build process.
Just from scratch?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. We strip it all the way down to the bare chassis and then build up from there. So it's essentially like an old but brand new car. You know?
Yeah.
Every component, every screw is essentially brand new.
That's amazing.
Replaced with carbon fiber. And or like the chassis is refurbished to new standards.
Do you kind of use a standardized engine with it? Or is it a client coming in saying, I want it to make 600 horsepower. What can you do for me?
Yeah. So we've we started with the coupes and speedsters. Those are all our 4-liter naturally aspirated motor, which was making about 430 horsepower. We are now completely sold out and finished production of those coupes and speedsters. So we're now moving into the turbo, which is the car we have out in your backyard. And that is 4-liter twin turbo, and it's roughly 840 horsepower.
That's insane. That's so much power.
We started off with a target of 700.
Yeah.
And then we ended up with 840. So our clients that ordered the car got an extra 140 horsepower upgrade for free.
Yeah, I guess word would spread pretty quick through the clients if you're giving them a couple extra 100 horsepower.
Yeah.
That's amazing. I mean, I had to go put gas in this thing right before this interview, and I'm so excited to drive it. It feels amazing. Are you calling it the turbo?
Yeah.
Is there any kind of like litigation that you're worried about with Porsche suing you?
No. We have a very positive relationship with Porsche Germany. And we try to abide by all the rules and guidelines that we are given. So we are pretty good.
Is it mostly like unspoken guidelines, or did they actually hand you kind of a spec sheet to like, you know, stay within the bumpers?
There are very specific brand guidelines that we have.
Okay.
That I cannot disclose because of our non-disclosure agreement.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's not just, you know, a blanket statement. They do have very specific guidelines that they want us to follow to make sure that we are not infringing upon the brand and, you know, hurting the brand in any way. So
I think if anything, you're just raising them up to extraordinary levels. So is it's not considered a Porsche after you guys are done with it. It's considered a Gunther Works. Does it have a model name?
So the name we call it, it's a Porsche 911.
Yeah.
Remastered by Gunther Works.
Okay.
Yeah. That's the way we describe it.
I like that term because it does feel like, you know, you listen to Steely Dan remastered and you're like, whoa, it does make it so much better with modern technology.
Right.
And I feel like you guys are bringing it into a new era. And it just, you picked the best, you know, generation of 911 in my view, to do it. Would you ever do water cooled Porsches?
We're definitely open to it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We have some, water cooled projects, coming up in the pipeline.
Cool.
Which I can't really mention the model name, but yeah, we have, more modern Porsches that we plan to work on.
Yeah. That's awesome. I feel like being open-minded about that is a good way to go into it. Cause at the end of the day, it's still a 911. Mm-hmm. It's still an amazing car.
Yeah.
It's so funny to get like bogged down about how it's cooled or, you know, like it doesn't really matter.
Air cooled, water cooled. Yeah. I'm good with both. As long as it's a Porsche 911, I'm, you know, I love working on them.
Yeah. And I feel like most of the people complaining about water cooled engines are never going to own a 911 in their life anyways. So why argue about it?
Right.
I do. One day I'm going to own a 911. And I made a promise when I was like a teenager that I'd own one before 40. And I got a couple months left. I still got some saving to do, but, yeah, I feel like the Gunther Works that I drove, we were talking about this a little bit before. I drove, mutual friend, Sean Lee, was doing a kid's toy drive and he owns a garage down in like El Monte or something. So one of the Gunther Works showed up. It was this beautiful kind of sage minty green 911 with, gold wheels. And, you know, me being kind of new to the group, I was very surprised that they gave me the keys and said, go take it out. And it was one of the best days of my life. And, I feel like it kind of ruined me in the way that like now when I get like, probably let's be realistic. I'll probably get a 996 911, with the fried egg headlights. it's going to be not as great as the Gunther Works that I drove that first time. So I feel like I'm always going to be chasing that dragon. But I'm going to get to drive this turbo after this interview and I'm never going to wash my hands again. do you own a couple of these cars at your house?
So yeah, the orange turbo is mine. And, I mean, they're really mine or also part of the company. So it's sort of same thing.
The ones that aren't client cars, you kind of share with the company.
Right.
Okay.
Exactly. Yeah.
This turbo is not a client car. This is kind of a test, like beta version. I wouldn't say beta, but
yeah,
like,
it's what we call the press car.
Yeah.
You know, we call it the village bicycle because everyone gets a ride in that car. Every journalist and all these YouTube reviewers have already driven the car. So we built it specifically for, you know, demonstrations, client test drives or journalists and whatever it is. So that's what it's for.
Yeah. And it's still built off a 993 chassis.
Correct. Yeah.
Cool.
We'll be right back after these messages. Now back to the show.
What can you tell me about the turbo other than the turbos that's different from the other cars that you've made?
So historically, most, you know, Porsche turbos were either 3.6 liter or 3.8 liter twin turbos. This engine is a 4-liter turbo, so it's very unique in that way that there's not a lot of 4-liter twin turbos that you see on a 911. And one of the reasons we did that is we wanted to originally hit that 700 horsepower number, but I didn't want to use bigger turbos because it creates turbo lag, because bigger turbos take longer time to spool up.
So it's two sequential turbos?
So it's two twin turbos, two turbos. And the way we can make the power is we use smaller turbos than we normally would, but because it has a 4-liter, it helps us get to that, you know, high level power number.
Yeah.
And also the critical thing was the cooling system that we had to design to make sure that it continues to perform. That took us several years to develop.
Wow.
And what was the biggest challenge about this package, this drivetrain, which now makes 840 horsepower,
that's so crazy,
and 600 pound feet of torque, is that we're putting like very, very high performance, almost hypercar level drivetrain into a 993, which is actually considered in today's standard a very, very small car.
Yeah. Right? It's tiny. You do kind of widen it out a bit.
Right.
And it's got fat tires. These tires are crazy.
So those small turbos really
hit right away. Yeah, they're very, very efficient. Yeah. The feedback we get from a lot of people is that they are shocked by the fact that there is no turbo lag on this car at all, as you felt.
Yeah.
There's no turbo lag. Its power is instantaneous.
It is crazy. And it's almost like EV level, like torque.
So the common thing that we hear a lot is that people think that it feels like there's like a naturally aspirated V12 in the back.
Wow.
Is there any kind of crash testing that you have to do?
You know, we are always keeping in mind the safety. That's one of the reasons why we don't modify the chassis and we keep the chassis intact. There are other companies that do a lot of chassis modification, and that to me, can compromise the safety of the car. So we don't touch anything that could be safety related. And we pretty much keep the original chassis intact.
That kind of acts as a loophole for you not to do crash testing?
Well, you know, we're not technically a car manufacturer per se, you know, like Porsche or BMW.
Yeah.
You know, we're not subject to new car homologation standards.
Is that something that would, if you were to accept bodies in white, that would be something that would be become part of the process?
Well, I think that would be more if you were to develop your own chassis.
Okay.
And we looked into the development of our own chassis, our carbon tub. But there comes other laws that come into play when you're developing your own chassis and your own VIN number. You do have to do crash testing. You have to do global homologation.
Mm.
And it takes several years to do and, you know, millions of dollars to develop. You know,
it's way better to just keep it boutique and do client by client.
Yeah. We're not trying to become a mass car manufacturer. Yeah. We're a very small boutique firm and we have a very niche clientele base.
Mm-hmm.
We're not trying to make a car that is for everybody. We just can't. I wish we could make the car more affordable, but the hand-build nature of these things, it just makes it not cost feasible. I wish we could make these cars and sell them for $100,000, but it's just completely unrealistic. We would go financially bankrupt in a few months if we had to do that.
That would make sense.
Yeah.
On the point of price, what's your price point for a normal car like this?
So our turbo program right now, the base price is around 1.45 plus options. So the options vary based upon the type of brakes, the type of wheels. We have aluminum wheels or magnesium wheels. We have unlimited amounts of paint ranges, you know, from metallic, pearl, candy, all the way to liquid metal paints that are very exotic.
Oh, yeah. The liquid metal silver is like a Classic, was it the 918 had it?
Yes.
If a client came in and was like, I want this color, and they brought in a little swatch of something, could you make that happen?
Absolutely.
So you are kind of mimicking what Porsche does with the, what is it, paint to sample
yeah
program?
I would say it's similar. Yeah.
You have these recommended colors that you use, though.
We don't really have, we do have a library of standard colors, but most of the clients we've met want a very, very specific paint.
Yeah.
And we have to literally develop the chemistry and develop these paints from scratch.
Wow.
Yeah. So we have to invent a lot of different paints that don't exist. These formulas, and sometimes it takes up to 6 months to develop a paint because we're just giving client multiple samples.
What's the most a client would pay for a specific type of paint if you're developing it for 6 months kind of thing?
There was one paint where we did a paint diffusion. So it was a candy paint diffusion. So the front end of the car is a tinted brown sort of carbon fiber, and then it diffuses into a solid paint towards the back.
Is it black on the back?
No, it's dark brown. So it's like a whiskey brown color.
I think I might have seen this one. Was this at the Broad Arrow auction in Long Beach?
No, it's not. It's not for sale.
It's not that one.
Yeah, it was on display at our Quail booth in Monterey 2 years ago.
Okay.
And then we recently finished a candy purple paint.
That's my
which
car.
Which is crazy because you have to paint it in the dark.
What?
Because it's so reflective. So you have to paint it with a flashlight. And the painter has to paint the whole car in one shot. You cannot take a break. So if the painter left in the middle and went for a bathroom break and then started painting the rest of the body panels, it would be a different color.
What?
Yeah.
How does that work? I don't understand.
So there's a lot of prep work involved in that.
Yeah.
And we got to make sure that the painter has doesn't need to go to the bathroom and has to paint the car in one shot and one go. It's the same as painting essentially three cars.
What?
That's the amount of work that is involved in it.
Holy crap.
Yeah.
And how long are they painting it for?
Probably about 5 to 6 hours.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Yeah. Give them like a catheter or something. So I don't understand why it has to be, it's so reflective that they need to use a flashlight.
Yeah.
Isn't a flashlight
pretty bright? You can't turn the paint booth on. It's too reflective. So you can't see what you're painting.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
It's like the opposite of that Vanta Black.
Right. Yeah. And then we spend so many hours hand sanding the paint. We put a lot more clear than what you typically see in a new car manufacturer. And that's how we can then color sand the paint to a level of glass. It's essentially completely flat. There is zero orange peel.
It's like piano gloss kind of.
Yeah.
Wow. And that's incredible.
Yeah. I mean, you just don't see, you know, cars being painted like that anymore. Everything is robotically done. There's a lot more orange peel. And it's going back to the roots of the old craftsmanship and paint that, you know, companies like, you know, Rolls-Royce or Aston Martin used to do. But they can't do that anymore because it's going more mass production.
Wow. That's incredible that you're kind of resurrecting that. So how much would that purple cost?
That purple paint job is probably like between $110,000 to $130,000 option.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you could get a 911 for just the price of this purple paint. That's insane.
I mean, if you look at the liquid metal for the 918 Spyder, it was around the same price. It was $130,000.
Same with, we talked to a guy who had a Ford GT in Mysticrome paint a while ago, and that cost him upwards of $100,000.
Yeah.
I mean, these are colors that people still talk about. So I think it's worth it.
It's a labor of love because it's like I said, it's like painting three cars.
Yeah.
And also the thing is the paints are also, you know, very sensitive in that if you have a panel that you scratch, it's very difficult to repair. So like I typically try to talk clients out of these paints.
Sure.
Because It makes it more nerve-wracking to drive. And if you get a scratch or like a rock chip that goes through the clear bra,
ruins your week.
It kind of is very difficult to repair. And so especially clients that, you know, really like to drive their cars and enjoy it without having that worry, I usually try to talk them off the ledge of picking some of these exotic paints. We prefer also not to do these paints because it's very time consuming. Sure. For us.
What percentage of the cars that you sell do you think actually make it to the track?
I would say probably less than 15%.
Wow.
Yeah.
So the people buying these kind of higher end paints, there's probably no chance they're taking it to, you know, Big Willow or Thermal or something like that.
So yeah, the candy purple one, surprisingly, the first place the client took it to was Spring Mountain Track. And oh my he tracked it on the first day.
And got some rock chips or no?
No, thankfully not. Because wow. The whole car, we clear bra everything, every panel.
Okay.
To protect it. But yeah. Sometimes if you do get a big enough rock that's sharp enough at a high speed, obviously it'll penetrate the clear bra.
Yeah. I mean, more power to that guy. You know, he's buying an expensive car. He might as well go use it for what it was intended for.
It's meant to be driven, you know? Yeah. These aren't supposed to be, you know, static paintings.
Yeah.
That are at a museum. You know, it's a performance car and that's what it's intended for.
Yeah.
They're supposed to be driven hard. So
what's your racing experience? Have you tracked a bunch of cars?
I don't have that extensive of a track experience, you know, but I do love going on a spirited drive on, you know, back canyon roads and but I don't have extensive track experience. No. I have a lot of drivers like who are, you know, professional drivers and motorsport drivers that will do the development for us.
Yeah.
And do give us feedback on the performance of our car and constantly refining it. But we hire, you know, people like that who are experts in that field.
That's cool.
Unfortunately, I'm nowhere close to that.
That's good. You just stay on the business side of it.
I'm better off building cars instead of driving them.
Yeah. That's a good point. On the subject of testing, you guys were just at Thermal testing the turbo for what, 4 days?
Correct. Yeah.
How did that go?
Testing went really well. We were setting up the car for 2 days for the specific track configuration at Thermal, and the setup really varies quite a bit from track to track. So the setup that works at Thermal may not work at Laguna Seca or Willow Springs.
Yeah.
Or Coda. It's every track has their own specific setup.
So you're in the pits, you know, adjusting suspension and stuff like that.
Correct.
What was different about Thermal that you learned?
Thermal doesn't have as long straightaways as like track like, let's say, Coda. So it's a very tight technical track, and cornering is really important. So we have to set up the car where, you know, it's a little more knife edge, and we also have to think about the wing attack angle. Where typically on like a track like Laguna, we would give it more wing, and it needs more downforce on certain corners and certain straightaways. But with Thermal, we put the wing in a pretty neutral position, and we're really focused on how the vehicle performs on the corners. Okay. Cornering was really the key because it's not a lot of long straightaways.
You took a little bit of edge off of the wing and downforce so that it had better handling?
Yeah. For example, in, Willow, we would definitely go, you know, more aggressive angle on the wing blade. And typically, we want to maximize the wing attack angle on a track like that.
Are you surprised with how well it's doing? You said that it's like, you know, inching up on GT3 cars, passing them in the straights kind of thing. Is that something that you had planned from the beginning, or is that just like a pleasant surprise?
I think based on the weight, the power to weight, you know, car weighing just over 2,700 pounds.
That's and insane.
840 horsepower. We kind of had an expectation of what the performance of the car.
Yeah. That's like if you were to ask like a 14-year-old what the perfect car is, they'd throw that those numbers out and be like, that's impossible. Yeah. You guys are making it happen.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we're not supposed to be having these types of performance numbers with a car from 1995, you know, and a 993 with license plates on, you know.
I always think about like if you were to teleport back to 1995 and show them this kind of car,
yeah,
they would lose their shit. No one would know what to do with it.
Yeah. It's definitely, we're definitely beating, you know, the laws of physics here. And,
yeah.
And, you know, we were, you know, right behind yesterday afternoon on our last session, driving behind an LMP car. And
a modern one?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Modern LMP car. And we out-accelerated that car on a straightaway.
What?
Yeah.
Wow.
So.
That's insane.
Yeah.
Does that mean there's a future Gunther Works team at Le Mans coming up?
I wouldn't say that, but we are working on unveiling a new car this year that is going to be a little more track focused.
Cool.
It's going to be a sort of like a GT3 Cup car.
Yeah.
With one race seat, no interior. We're going to go after, you know, losing even more weight and try to get it close to 2,400 pounds.
No way.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. So,
that should be interesting. We're going to have that shown for the first time in August.
Wow.
In Car Week.
I'm excited for that.
We'll be right back after these messages. Now back to the show.
I was at the Quail last year and I saw your slant nose. It was amazing. Is that kind of a one-off or are you offering that as well?
So we're doing a limited production run of those.
Okay.
It's our twin turbo on steroids and it has an E85 flex fuel system. So if you put E85 in there, the computer automatically recognizes it and it changes the boost parameters.
Wow.
So without E85 on regular pump gas, it's making just under 900 horsepower. But if you put the 85, you're just under 1,100 horsepower.
Oh my God.
And we're only making 26 of those. It's a very limited production car. Only less than half of those will actually stay in the United States. The other half is going to be, you know, distributed globally between Middle East, Europe, and Asia.
Yeah.
But we picked the slant nose concept because it's aerodynamically the most efficient way of, especially air that hits the front end of the car is the most important.
You know? Yeah. Does it have pop-ups?
It does not have pop-ups. So we had internal discussions on whether we wanted to do pop-ups or not. And back then, you know, these slant nose had pop-up headlights because they didn't have modern technology. It was halogen-based lights, right?
Yeah.
And in order to be able to have halogen lights light up at night to be able to see what you're driving, you know, you needed a bigger housing to do that because it was just not powerful enough. And that's one of the reasons why they created pop-ups. But with modern technology today with LEDs, we can get like a very thin headlight.
Yeah.
And bright and have it brighter than a very big pop-up headlight. And the other reason is that a pop-up headlight creates drag. So when that pop-up headlight is up, it's creating a lot of wind resistance and drag. And it just is not aerodynamically efficient. And for us, as I told you before, we're really, really focused on performance.
Performance
first, looks come second.
Yeah.
And so we don't want to go after it just because of looks or nostalgia.
Sure.
We want to go after it for performance reasons.
Are you part of the design process for the aero and the looks department?
Yes, I am. I oversee everything.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy to just have a hand in everything and it be so put together. You know, normally people who try to wear too many hats have at least one area where they're not so good at. It feels like you're good at literally every part of making a car. So congrats on being the most talented person in the world.
I wouldn't say that at all. I'm you know, just surrounded by very, very talented people.
Yeah.
And
that's the humble answer.
I'm just putting everything together. Like I said, I clean the toilets and I sign the checks. That's all I do.
Were you a big fan of like the 935 slant nose back in the day?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What would you say is your top favorite Porsche of all time?
That's an easy answer. Carrera GT.
Carrera GT?
Yeah.
Do you own one?
I unfortunately don't. I'm hoping and planning to get one day.
Yeah.
That is something that we're looking at as a future program for us.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But I love the Carrera GTs, and I wish like 10, 15 years ago, I had the money to buy it when it was only $300,000.
Oh my God.
And now they're like 2 million and over, you know? So yeah they're obviously going up in price because it's such an incredible car.
Yeah. I got to sit in Doug DeMuro's, and he has, I called it baseball leather. It is like, baseball mitt leather with like the light stitching and stuff.
Yeah.
And it's the best smelling leather I've ever smelled. It's so good.
So that leather is actually called terracotta.
Terracotta. Okay. Yeah. You probably have a lot of very demanding clients that know specifically exactly what they want and are like set in, they won't take no for an answer. Have you run into many difficult clients that kind of have expectations beyond what you can deliver?
I'd say most of our clients are very, very easy to work with. Most of our clients. We've had a very, very small handful of clients where it was more, I would say, more challenging because especially when it comes to paint department and they're like, we're trying to develop a paint and we ended up doing like 30 different kinds of paints and they still can't make up their mind. Yeah, they can't make up their mind because they don't exactly know what they want. So those are the only challenges that we've had.
Yeah.
But for the most part, like I would say that most of our clients are very, very easy to work with.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. I would imagine, you know, they're coming to you. They already know what the product is and they are coming to you because they want your product. Mm-hmm. It's not like, they're not coming to you like, build me this car. It's like, I want one of your cars, you know?
Yeah. I mean, some clients know exactly what they want, what paint they want, what options they want. And we just guide them. Some clients come in going, I have no idea what I want. And I would like your recommendation. And that's what they pay us for, is they pay us for our advice and our knowledge. So it's kind of a journey that we go through together with a client, and it's fun.
Sounds fun. What does a typical lead time look like for someone putting their order in to the time of delivery?
It's roughly about 2 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this is like a not only monetary investment, but it's something that you're kind of talking with them throughout the whole process for literal years.
Yeah.
Until their car is done.
Yeah. Two, sometimes 3 years. You know, some of the bills that have taken longer has taken up to 3 years. And some of the clients, after the vehicle is delivered, they have FOMO and they're like, okay, I feel like I need to build another car with you because I feel awkward not calling you every week talking about the car with you.
I mean, that says volumes about how you conduct your business.
Right. So we're building a relationship with the clients. You know, it's not just about ordering a car from a new car dealership and wait for the car to show up 3 months later. It's a build journey and you develop a relationship with them. You get to know them and it's really fun from both sides, from the client side and also from our side. We're lucky to get to spend this much time with this quality level of people.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I want to go back to the Carrera GT because I feel like starting a program, remastering the Carrera GT is not only going to piss a lot of people off because they think it's the perfect car, but like how fun is it to imagine what is possible from that V10 and like get even more performance out of one of the most, you know, ultimate performance machines. Can you tell anything about what you're planning for it?
I can't talk too much about it, but I think that, you know, the Carrera GT was, manufactured, in 2000.
Yeah.
So there's technology has come a long way since 2000.
A lot more ceiling to explore.
Yeah. There's a lot more things accessible to us, you know, with exotic lightweight materials and aerodynamics and downforce. And so I would say that we're going to apply that technology and try to enhance the Courier GT while keeping the original design intact as much as possible, and that spirit alive. We don't want to, take away from, you know, the greatness of the car. So we have to be very, very careful with that. It's a very, very finicky situation.
If someone sends you a donor car, like, they are putting 100% trust in you to make it like an already amazing car better.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you're going to have to do a little bit of surgery, which is terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we've all seen that Gimbala Mirage,
mm-hmm,
that crashed in New York a while ago.
Yeah.
And just, you know, the collective car community just holding their heart and being like, oh no.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's unfortunate.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, besides Gimbala, there's also, Zagato that also did a small run of Courier GT, you know?
Yeah. And Zagato, you know, legacy design house, but they have, you know, thousands of employees compared to 100 people, mm-hmm, at Gunther Works. Where does the name Gunther Works come from?
It's an inspiration from Gunther Wendt, who is a German astronaut engineer.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. And so he was born in Germany. He was a very, very talented engineer, and he moved to the United States. And he's the last person that the astronauts see before they fly to space.
Wow.
So if you look at Apollo 13, the movie, that Gunther Wendt is actually in the movie with Tom Hanks and everything.
Oh, wow.
So it's kind of like sort of the same story with us, where we're taking the Porsche 911 that's originally born in Germany.
Yeah.
And it sort of comes to California and gets a new life. And so it's a German California sort of thing.
That's cool. You know? That's very poetic. I like that. You know, you never know the etymology of names, but I feel like that's one of the better ones. You could have easily called it Peter Works.
I don't think that name is very appealing.
Peterbilt.
Peter Works or Nam Works. I don't know. It's not very inspiring.
Would you consider your four boys part of the 100 employees?
No, definitely not.
They don't do anything?
They're too young. Yeah. My 14-year-old son is right now getting into racing.
Yeah.
And he's just really getting started. But hopefully he becomes a future development driver for Gunther Works.
That'd be cool.
So I can save some money.
Yeah. You get paid in lunch.
Yeah, exactly.
So the oldest one is the only one that's showing any interest in cars?
Yeah, my oldest and my third son is, they're both like into karting and
Cool.
Yeah, they're really into racing. So we'll see. We'll have to see from, you know, I don't try to influence them to get into cars. This is all on their own.
Yeah.
You know?
That's
if anything,
great.
I tried talking my oldest son out of getting into racing.
Sure.
Because it's very expensive. I was like, you have to play golf or tennis. It's a lot cheaper.
Yeah. Are they good at tennis?
My son played a little bit of tennis, but he was not that good.
So you're still top dog in your house with tennis?
Well, I'm not top dog at all. You know, I've got knee problems, so I can't really play.
Yeah.
Pickleball is where it's at now, right?
Yeah. Are you going to have a pickleball court at your house at Thermal?
So I have a pickleball court at my house in the desert.
Yeah.
I am still in the process of building the house at Thermal because we just got the lot.
Cool.
It'll be a couple of years before it's built, you know. But
yeah.
We're trying to make a sort of a Gunther Works delivery home.
Oh, very cool.
So when a client takes delivery, they have the option of doing the thermal delivery.
That's amazing.
And they can take delivery at our new Gunther Works headquarters home in Thermal.
That's such a good idea.
And they get to drive on the track.
Wow.
And have a private lunch or dinner catered by a chef at the house. So
that's amazing.
That's our plans. Yeah. It's a nice way to take delivery, you know?
Yeah. Oh, that'd be so special if I was a client like that. Oh man, that sounds fun. To just like live on, you know, a backyard racetrack and just go out whenever. What's the process like for submitting, you know, a claim to the land there and building a house?
The process is pretty straightforward. You contact Thermal and you can either buy an existing spec house that's already built, or you can buy a plot of land and then build your dream home. You know, typically those homes are 3 stories tall and they range from like 8,000 all the way to like, there's one house that is like 40, 50,000 square feet.
What?
Yeah.
Wow.
Where it's like almost like a car museum. So there's quite a wide range of homes there. It's very interesting.
That is interesting. It's interesting that someone would build such a massive house considering it's like, you know, you're not going to live there for more than a couple months out of the year.
Yeah. It's like their third or fourth home.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then when you're there, like every like 2 minutes, there is a private Gulfstream landing right next to the track, because the airport is right next to it. There's a private airport there.
Wow. So between that and the race cars, you're probably not getting a ton of sleep.
I mean, it's like billionaire central over there. There's so many wealthy people there.
Yeah.
Most of them have private jets. I'm probably the only person that, rolls up there in a car.
It's been this like kind of cool, mysterious brand that I've always loved for, you know, since you guys have started. And it's really cool to hear that you guys, you know, it wasn't all daisies the whole time. It was like a process to get to the point where you're at right now, and kind of prove to the car world that like, you're not ruining Porsches. You're making them so much better. I just really hope you continue to do more models, you know, expand into different generations and stuff like that. And I think I really respect what you guys do.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that.
So right now we're going to take a drive in the Turbo and we're going to go get lunch. We'll see you in a sec. All right, getting in the Gunther Works Turbo right now. We're going to go get lunch. So we're headed to Mickey's Italian Delicatessen and Liquor down in Hermosa. Apparently it's a pretty classic spot that Lucky Costa told me about. The driver that dropped this car off, he mentioned that this was still in track mode.
So you have this knob here, this is the drive mode.
You have comfort, sport, and track. So this comfort is around 500 horsepower. Sport is 700, and then track is the full beat, 840.
Yeah. It sounds amazing. Does the drive mode affect the exhaust note at all?
Absolutely. In track mode, it just has a lot more pumps and burbles, and it's actually very loud. It sounds like a race car.
Do you get a lot of attention driving this?
Unfortunately, yeah. This is an attention magnet. It is sometimes annoying. You go to gas station or freeway, people are taking videos and photos of you. And just, at the end of the day, it's just a Porsche 911, but I don't know, for some reason, this is just a crowd magnet everywhere it goes.
Holy shit! This is a literal rocket. That's insane. Was it just me or did I feel the tires spin in like third gear?
Yeah.
Holy crap. Guys, thank you so much for watching Talk Talk Nation this week. Peter Nam, thank you so much for being here. Catch us every other week on Thursdays. We have awesome guests coming up for you. And subscribe, like, do all that whole shebang. And we'll see you in 2 weeks. Bye.